This is the time to address a crisis when we're not facing it. I think I can make a lot more conversation with myself and with my kids and my family when we are not right in the middle of it. So that's part of the thing that I think makes sense, and that's a theme I'm going to develop a little bit as we go along. But the things that I wanted to talk about were the things that I had thought about. Esther and I joined a burial society, and what they do is they give you some kind of a sheet. I forget that they've got some kind of a name for it, but it amounts to a list of the things that you're thinking about, and you're supposed to write that out. Well, I did, filled that in, and I gave it to them at the burial society, and there were some of those things that I wanted to talk about. And they were some things like this. As a Christian, I began to think that the burial of the body is more sin than it is honoring. And the reason I thought about that is that we have a friend, we live near the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, which does a lot of research in terms of disease of the body, particularly in relationship with cancer and that kind of thing. And one of our friends is a woman who's a physician on one of those research teams, and I remember asking her, how important is it for you to get gifts of bodies? And her answer was not the whole body, but for tissue, because her particular focus. She said, without those, we really have a very difficult time, because their whole thing is based on not theory, but trying to take an actual look at what is. Well, I remember growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, during the Depression years. My brother was going to the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, living at home. That was the cheapy way. It was cheaper to pay the trolley car out to East Liberty than it was to try and live someplace else. And I remember I really helped Harold through medical school. Most of these fingers did it. I remember when he'd say to me, John, can you come here a minute? I would go in and hold him my hand. He had a little tool that he put down on my finger, and when I wasn't looking, he pressed a little catch and went like that, and he took it away, and then he said, oh, look, it's bleeding. Can I have some of that? So for his medical training, I bled. But in the process of his medical education, he used to talk about his cadaver, and this was a body that they had in the medical school. And as I inquired about that, he said, well, it was somebody that nobody claimed the body for. And so that cadaver, there were two students to a body, and it gave them the chance to cut through the skin and see where the nerves were and where the muscles were and where the bones were and what abnormal or abnormalities were, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of the things that I've thought in these years is that Harold was really able to help, I don't know, how many thousands of people when he's been in practice. And that there was somebody who maybe without knowing it gave their life, their body in that case, for the sake that others might live. And that sounds like a pretty good concept of what faith invites me to do. And I thought, well, maybe one of the things I might do is contribute my body to a medical school when I die. That's part of me, because I'm thinking, you know, that's kind of an honor to what has happened for my brother in being a medical doctor. I thought it's a way in which I can affirm others who are now in training as medical personnel to be able to learn that. I think that's better than putting my body in the ground, and if anybody reaches for it, slapping their hands, take their hands off. Whoops. I didn't mean it. That rather than insisting that it has to lie there and rot, you know, shouldn't I give what I am and have for the sake of others? Seems to me that that's what Christ always invites us to do. So from my point of view, that's a very good kind of thing that might be done. Well, I thought about that, and I thought of some of the other options. You know, one of the other options is to give organ donations. That doesn't mean pipe organs, by the way. But it does mean, for example, that the Lions Club has what they call a national bank of eyes. And it means that maybe somebody can have sight through eyes. I've had astigmatism. I don't know whether my eyes are good for anybody else. They really work neat for me. But they may or may not be helpful. But one of the things I decided was, and in Maryland, you put on your driver's license organ donor. So that if I am killed on the highway, and they do, by some chance, find out my name, and a driver's license is where they go for it, they will see on their organ donor, which means then they have to treat and recognize some of those things in terms of the treatment of the body. And that means, for example, probably checking with a family and calling the Lions group and asking them, for example, to take the eyes. The other place that they ask for organs are kidneys. And I found out some things there that, you know, you can or you cannot donate them. They're really only helpful if it's in the same bloodline because of the whole problem of trying to get a body to accept that. Well, some of these things I thought about, and so I said on my birthday I would like to express to my family that what I would really like is to give my body to a medical school. In the D.C. area, we have three. Is it three? It's four. Well, there's really three within our immediate reach. Georgetown University has a medical school, the George Washington Medical School, and the Howard University Medical School. So those three I wrote to and asked for information on how this could be done legally and the like. And I know also that I could donate to the University of Maryland, which is located 30 miles away in Baltimore, Maryland. Their medical school is there. And it was interesting to discover that part of the issue is that in D.C., you must pay somebody like a funeral director to take your body from the hospital to the wherever you die. If you die not in the one that you're not giving to, then you have to pay somebody to take it there. Well, I grew up as a penurious Lutheran. And that means penny pinching. And I discovered that in Maryland, you don't have to pay anything. You know, anybody that can drag the thing there can get it there. So one of the things I said was, now I would like, and I explained to the kids why I wanted to do this because of my brother, and I said that in my exuberance to my son Paul, I said, now if I die here at home, if that's my privilege, what I would like is that you take my body to the medical school over in Maryland because you can do it for free. And I said, we had a Beetle, and I said, you can prop me up in the back seat. If you think I've gotten rigid, we have the roof rack that's on the basement, put it on there. And his answer was, oh, Dad. Well, now that was my first learning. What I learned was that what I want, I have the witness to bear. What I expect, I do not have the right to expect. You know, for me, I'm dead, could care less. And so that the fact that whether he would fold me into the back seat or prop me up or put me on the roof rack or whatever, really didn't make any difference to me. I mean, as I think about it, you know, so at that point, so what? It's an empty suitcase. But when it comes to Paul, that isn't true. You know, I would just flip it and say that that's Paul and I've got to do the job. Everything's different. Now, let me put this another way. That learning came to me when, as I said, I filled out that preference sheet for the burial society and I sent it in to the president of the group and I saw him later on. I had sent that in. What do you do with it? And he said, well, we throw it in the closet, I said. You know, that's important stuff to me. He said, well, it doesn't make any difference. Because when you write it out, being in my closet or your safe deposit vault or anything else doesn't make any difference unless somebody knows what's in it at a time when it counts. I learned that the issue is not writing it out, but sharing it. And coupled with that, I think what I learned was that I need to share with my family what I want, but at the same time give them the absolute freedom to do what they need to do without any sense of guilt. Now the first one is me saying the things that are important to me, whether they happen or not. It seems to me that I'm saying something about my stewardship of life included in death. But now where I'm seeing this coupled back as I think about what happens in life is then I'm beginning to care for those who are around me in life, and I don't want to hurt them when I'm alive, I don't want to hurt them when I'm dead. And so that the issue is, I think, to share the kinds of things that go on for me in faith, but at the same time, allow them and give them the absolute freedom to have no bindings on them, no guilt, that they know what they will have to do, and they can go do it. And what I mean by have to do, you know, there's just so many things. For instance, what if we happen to be somewhere, let's say that on our way home from Holden, we die. From the economic point of view, I'm content not to have my body hauled home, you know, that it can be gotten rid of there. That's the economic and safe thing to do. And if that's what the kids would decide that needed to be done, fine. If they decide that they do want to hang at home, haul at home and pay a lot of money, that's fine. I mean, in other words, I'm saying that kind of total freedom. There are other issues that get involved, and as we talk things through, these items became clear. For example, I think I can do this, Esther, without an embarrassment. That's the one thing that she said I should not do, is embarrass her too much. When you think about whether or not she is, let me start this way, and I think that's okay to say. She's uncomfortable with the idea of giving my body to a medical school. And I can turn that around, because I can think, you know, that if I would see Esther give her body to a medical school, I would have a lot of discomfiture about that. I think I can see that. Because you hear a lot of, which I didn't, also know isn't always true, a lot of the way in which the uncomfortableness of the medical students is dealt with humor about the dead bodies. And I want to say that's discomfiture. I don't think they are that blasé, but what do you do when you're in the midst of something that you're uncomfortable with? Frequently we deal with it in an effort to be humorous. I've been in the operating rooms when my brother was operating, or he worked as an anesthesiologist. I can say that. I remember some of the way in which they banter and joke back and forth. If you've seen MASH, I think that's kind of the way it is. And one time the nurse was apparently watching me, and she said afterwards, you know, I bet you think that's pretty calloused of us. And I said, well, I don't know. I just wonder about it. And she said, it's the only way we can manage. If we're too serious about what's going on there, when something serious happens, we're so emotionally involved, we can't do what we need to do to react quickly to handle the situation. So she said, we do this kind of banter because it's the only way we can survive in doing something that important. So she was teaching me something about the way in which there's an anomaly. Things don't seem to fit together, and yet they do. Well, one of the things that we got into was this issue of whether or not my body could be donated to a hospital. And recognizing that that might be uncomfortable for Esther, then I had to think about the options. What are the other options? One would be to give my eyes. I cannot give my kidneys and still have anything go anywhere, so the most that you can do is give your eyes. If you want to give your kidneys, our friend at NIH said give them. The fact that they can't be used for you, they can be used for research. Fine, okay? Now, if we've cut that out, then what are you going to do with the rest? All right, you've got two options. And one is cremation, and the other is burial. Both are appropriate. And this is just to sketch out some of the things that we've thought about, and I'm sure that many of you have thought about them, and I'm not trying to say this is all new ground. But as we thought about it, the issue with cremation, the things that we thought about there is, what if our daughter is in Miami, Florida, and can't get home for 2 or 3 days? What are we going to do with the body? Well, you've got a couple options. One is you can put it in a cold storage. You put it in the refrigerator, as it were. And that's legal. Yeah, you know, you can do that because the body will not deteriorate so rapidly. The issue was, as I saw it, is that, again, as I think about those who are alive, the difficulty of being able to associate, you know, what my mind tells me and what I'm sensing is that whole denial process that comes along. You've had that experience, I'm sure, when somebody died that you were close to, of saying, you know, this is like a strange dream. Maybe I'll wake up. And what I'll do is discover that it was nothing more than a dream. But one of the things that is helpful is that if you can, in fact, see the person who is dead and know that, in fact, they are dead, then maybe you can get there. That showed up for us a couple of ways. Esther helped me this in thinking about this as she talked about the death of her sister who died when Jean was about 13 or 14, somewhere in that area. And Esther's just a year or two younger than that. And one of the things that happened in their home was that the casket was brought, Jane's body was embalmed, and the casket was brought to their home. And it stood there for a couple of days, and friends would come to visit the family, and so that there was Jane's body. And Esther said how she had gone in there in the morning one time as she got up and looked at Jean in the casket and just stood there trying to let this soak in a little bit. And one of the things that suddenly happened was that she thought she saw Jean move. And so she went to her mother and said, "Mother, Jean moved." And mother said to her, "No, Jean is dead. And what you saw was, you know, just your imagination." They checked it out. They had that time to do it. That shows up, I understand, with people. I remember one woman saying that she had a vision of her husband standing at the foot of her bed after he died. Now, this after the funeral. He was gone. His body was dead. She knew that. Had been buried. But this whole fantasy, is it really true? Is that true? And she saw it with, maybe it isn't because she saw this vision. Now, there are other things involved there, but that's at least one of them. Now, the thing that I thought about was that if our daughter or our son, and those are the ones that I immediately cared about, the rest of you, as far as I'm concerned, are going to have to fend for yourself. But it's my family, and it is for you, your family. They need the chance to have some way to know that it's for sure. And if that's appropriate, and we've talked about this, then that's one of the things around which a decision has got to be made. What is appropriate so that they can make a decision and understand and deal with what has happened? I remember Bill, this friend, talking about, I think it was something like 10 or 12 days that they kept Pat's body. Because they had made a decision that they were going to keep the burial until after the memorial service. And he said that they went as a family to the funeral home where the body was kept. It was interesting because Pat had worked with this funeral home. And we'd done a lot of discussion way back before she knew that she was so heavily infected with cancer. As she talked about some of the things that she thought about in dealing with this. But they went to the funeral home and had a little a family service in closing the casket. The casket was closed and nailed shut so that it was not opened at the church at all. And it was very difficult for them to do that, but they were involved. The mother was having a difficult, very difficult time because the daughter had started with a mastectomy, and the mother now, just about a year ago, had a mastectomy also. And so, you know, you can imagine the intertwining of those two things. But for the mother, when she went to the funeral home, she said, "I'm going to put the makeup on Pat." And that was a healing experience. The kids were able to go along and watch this happen, and that was a healing experience. They were there when the casket was closed and helped to do it to the extent that they could, and that was a healing experience. Last week here, Ron Burke had a session on the death of his father, And there was a member of the Holden community at that point who talked about when his father died, he said, "I made the casket for my dad." And he said that was a healing experience. And so that out of that, he said, "I cried a lot as I did it, but it was a healing thing that I was able to do." Part of the thought is, and I don't know how, and there's no way you can predict this. I think the question is, how do you deal with it as you face life? Can we do those things that allow us to be healing? I remember a young woman close in our family who sat with her mother, with whom she had been estranged for quite a while, sat with her mother as she died. And I think even, she called for her dad. And he supported her head as she died. But the fact that she was involved, able to wash her mother, able to help her when she was in pain, helping to feed her just little droplets of water when she could hardly swallow, all that was a healing experience. It seems very painful in the process, and it is. But at the same time, it seems to me that it allows it to work. So one of the things that I think is that we need to allow more room for healing through pain. I'm not saying cause pain. Don't want to say that. I'm just saying that through pain comes much healing in my experience. And that I can't create it, but I guess I have to allow it. And I have to be ready to experience it myself in my life. Now here again is where I see this thing folding back and on top of me in terms of my life. That is, I think and talk about some of this, I see some of it there. Another thing that I guess I want to say that I think that is important to me to try and deal with it up front like this is so that I do not let my beliefs of faith become really denials of death. That line is so close that as I sing, I know that my hope is in nothing less than Jesus Christ and his righteousness, and that I will live because he lives. I don't want for me and for those with whom I have associations of faith to let that become really a denial of death. I see it as these two lines. Just the fact that I can say hello because my faith invites me to know that because he lives, I live also. Faith also demands for me that I take very seriously the word goodbye. That it's not Auf Wiedersehen. It is goodbye. And for me it is to say literally, I know that this is not until later. Now that's all in God's hands. And that the one thing that I have a chance to deal with once is goodbye. And so part of that is dealing with that now. I'm 61, and as our little friend said, she's 3 and a half. I am 61 and a half. I'm at the stage where I rejoice much with the presence of my life and the past and what it has brought to me. But one of the things that now in my life that God has given me by living in a time of peace, and I guess I want to say this, that everything I'm talking about is a gift of peace. A gift of war, a gift of violence, even such as a car accident. A lot of the things that I'm thinking about have to do with dying a natural death, whatever that is. Everything else, this is kind of a luxury that we have. But in dealing with that, the issue is to try and be able to deal with it as openly and as honestly as we can, and deal with it as we live with it now. I lost my train of thought on that one. I guess maybe the next thing is what I want to do is just say some of the things that have been helpful to me and to us that we've been doing, and then let's just open it to discussion. some of the things that we have done is to do some of the things that normally we wouldn't do. There was one day that, I don't remember whether it was a holiday or what, somehow it was a day that we both were free from work obligations, and so we used that day to visit funeral parlors and to talk to somebody there about the kind of arrangements we would like to make. There's some things that happened that we laughed at, and I'm not trying to laugh at the funeral industry. There are many fine, faithful, loving Christian people who operate there. But the issue for us is to know what we want to buy from them and what we don't. And I would say to you, the time to do that is beforehand. Well beforehand, make up your heads. Like Pat said to me when we were talking about funeral homes, and she worked in one, she said, when you have a death and you send the body to the funeral directors, and then you go over to talk about arrangements, and you don't like what's happening, she said, it's very difficult to say to that person, I don't like what you're doing, I'm going to take my body and go someplace else. You're stuck. That was what Pat said. Now, pre-arrangements are getting clear, first of all, in your head that you're buying stuff. You're buying furniture called a coffin. You're buying services such as help in transportation, arrangements, organization of people, etc., etc. You're buying that. And it's important to decide ahead what you want to buy and what you don't want to buy. What kind of things, and this has been very helpful for me, and I think for us to talk with people who have gone through some of this and to see some of the things that you might anticipate. But what we did on that particular day was we went to a funeral home and said to the fellow we were trying to talk about future arrangements for our funerals. And it's very interesting. They try and psych out, what in the heck are you doing there? Are you a newspaper person? Are you playing with them? Or what? What allowed this guy to take us seriously was he has been used to dealing with people who belong to a burial society who say that advanced planning is so important. And so with that, then he was able to sit down with us. And he told us some things I didn't know. I don't know where whether it applies all around, but in the D.C. area, what we're dealing with there is syndicates. I don't mean the mobsters. I mean syndicates that own the funeral homes and the cemeteries. It's now a super big business. And that the same people who own a number of different funeral homes under different names, it looks like they're family establishments, but they're all part of this large conglomerate. They also own a number of the cemeteries. There's only the public cemeteries in the D.C. area. I think there were only two out of about eight that were not a part of a syndicate. That was a whole new learning for me. This guy was honest enough to share that. We went also to one of the non-syndicated cemeteries. It's owned by an Episcopal congregation, and the congregation is very small, and they have seen as their mission supplying burial plots to people around the area. It's a very large, very beautiful cemetery, and they do a lot of thinking about that. The questions we wanted to ask was, do you have to have a vault? And he said it depends on where you bury. If you bury over in that section, you're allowed to bury too deep. And by burying too deep, you're counting on the thing rotting, and so that you can get another one in on top of it. I first learned this when I was in New York City, over in the Lutheran Cemetery in Long Island. You could bury three deep, but you had to allow so many years between because you had to count on that thing settling down in there. But if you bury in another place, you're going to have a vault, and you only bury one deep. And then we asked what the vault cost, and we discovered what the opening costs were. And the opening costs today, and opening and closing of a grave, were really just blasted my head, the cost of those things. And that was my beginning of thinking, hey, there's got to be a less expensive way to do that. This gentleman who was here last week, he said we were able to do our funeral for $300. The normal price would have been $1,300. So he said what we did was we paid the $300 and took the other $1,000 and gave it to Mother Teresa. Now here's a Christian witness as to way in which you can set some priorities. That was fine for them. I'm not saying that has to be for you or for me. But these are some of the things that are helpful when you start to get into them. Well, in order to simply keep our options open, one of the things that I decided was that if I was, Esther really feels more comfortable about thinking of burying the body than cremating it or giving it to a hospital. So I don't know what that decision is going to be if I precede her in death. But what we did is we went to a cemetery that one of our churches had. I thought, you know, I like that old symbolism of the church in which some of the rural congregations that I served, they simply took the plot of ground that somebody had given, put a church building on it, and used the rest of it for burial. And way back in history, the psalmody and the worship often was, they didn't have places where they got dressed, the clergy and the servers, in the church building. They had to dress someplace else. So when they got dressed, then what they did was as they would go into the church, they would walk through the cemetery and then on into the church. And when they were walking, what they do is they sang psalms. And so that was the history, as I understand it, of the intro. It was the entrance into the church. And so there was a constant reminder of the community of faith that is both alive and gone on. It was called the church triumphant and the church militant. I have that backwards. The church militant is those of us who are still present here and able to talk, and the church triumphant are those who are triumphant in the Lord. And so that sense is there. And so we thought about that, and we're able to get a cemetery lot in one of our churches. For my faith expression, that sounds right. We couldn't get what we wanted in the sense that if the church was there, they're separated by about a mile and a half. But at least for me, that sounded like a kind of an option. Now, what we've been trying to do is to talk ahead and try and arrive at some of those things. Now, let me turn it back. The thing that I'm saying is, being able to take on and talk about when we are not facing the stress of it, the stresses that will come when we die, I do not believe will reduce the stress for those who remain. If Esther dies before I do, I don't think our having talked any of these things ahead will make me feel the pain any less. The one thing it will not do, though, I hope, is to leave me with the complication of having to deal with so many things that will not allow me, in a way, to start dealing with some of that pain. Well, some of the other things do that. Second thing is that I think that it has contributed to our life now by allowing us to see how death and life are part of what God has made. They are inseparable, and as He has given us and supports us enough to live with the life that we have now, I believe He's also given to us some ways in which we can deal with that which comes. Maybe what I'm experiencing is really a part of our generation, because as I think about the people who don't live in the sophisticated urban centers, all of these things get dealt with sometimes in a much more open, direct way. But at least for my journey in faith, it has been very helpful. I am not speaking for Esther. The whole way I'm through is speaking for this, and my hope is that it gives, if you haven't thought about it, it gives you the courage and perhaps even the necessity to think and talk with as openly as you can, and it's not going to happen once. We've been at this for, as I said, about 6 years. And you need sometimes, and if God gives you that kind of length, use it in order that what happens between those to whom you have a close commitment, that can kind of happen now. So that's really my sense of it, is that as I try and talk about it, it is that it will deal and relate to the life that we are living now with the knowledge that sooner or later that bridge, that river, that crossing has to be made later on. So let's open it from there.
John?
Yes, ma'am.
I think you've touched on the three issues. One is, what about my death? Another is, what about my death when I die and the people who are close to me? Another is, what about the people who are close to me to die? That's a real sensitive one for me, and it's raked up a lot of feelings and emotions. And I sense that that's so for a lot of people in the room. I think a lot of people here are teary as I am.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I know I'm in need of a hug. If there's anyone else that is too, I would offer. Let's all go in the corner and do that. But the issue for me was my father, when he died, there were a lot of things between us that were never resolved. I never really had a chance to tell him the things that I, in retrospect, would have wanted to tell him. So I found myself as a grown man in the shower that morning upon hearing the news from the hospital, not being willing to show my emotions to the rest of the family, just sitting down on the floor of the hot shower and crying. Not necessarily in hurt and pain so much as anger. Why did he do that? Why did he die before I had a chance to resolve that and say to him what I wanted to? And the lesson that served up to me, and it was a very painful one, is that I want to try to resolve those things and say those things to the people that I know now who are living so that I don't carry that away from another relationship.
Thank you. And that's a way in which that speaks to your life. And I appreciate that other thought, you know, the tactile kind of support that we can be to each other. Very important. I think I want to remember that. Yes?
A week ago today was my mother's funeral, and we went through the, the family agony of coming to grips with what the world expects and what we expected of ourselves at that time. And it's made me want to also put down what I want, whether or not that's what my children want at that time or my husband is up to them. But I guess one of the things that bothered me is that, you know, it's my firm belief in faith that what we do for people when they're alive is important, not when they're dead. And yet the funeral director, when he had us all there, and there were eight of us, so there were my brothers and sisters, and I mean, we felt the support of one another. He, again, in a small town with no competition and one funeral home, except the one that in that town happened to be known as the Catholic funeral home. There is a smaller one, and that's probably not at all right, but that's the way it's known. He said, this is just for your information. The costs thus far are $1,260 before the casket. And I thought, what could they have possibly done for my mother that would have cost $1,260? My mother never could afford to even stay in a hotel room in her life. And yet, I mean, I don't know how much it cost to embalm a body, but I thought, this is not my mother. This is not my mother's character. And I guess that just was so eye-opening to me that it was frightening in some ways. And I think families need to be prepared for that kind of thing. As you say, you're buying a service that they think they're providing, which maybe you don't even want, but I don't know how to get around. I don't know what possibilities of getting around that for families are. And I guess maybe I'm just ventilating some thoughts that have been sort of smoldering for a week too, but you think death is going home to the Lord, and yet we have all these other things to think about and concern ourselves with, and yet the one we love, who lived a simple life of faith all of her life, we had to make these decisions which seemed unrealistic sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that bothered me, and maybe this is, I know this is not true in larger metropolitan cities, because in our city we have seen funerals advertised for much less. He said, in addition to the $1,260, now you will need to choose a casket. And he said, I'll just show you into the casket room, you know. And he said, we have one casket which is available. It's called our county casket. And he said, that's the cheapest casket. And, you know, if they would have just left it wood, it would have been beautiful, but they covered it with a very ugly gray flannel, which you would be embarrassed to bury your mother in. Even though firmly I believe that it doesn't matter how they're buried, and yet there's still that matter of, she's my mother, and we can't bury her in a gray flannel casket, you know? And so you go more money because of the embarrassment of the world. And maybe that's because we don't have enough faith to say it doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. I don't know. But, you know, I just think all those things, as you say, need to be thought about before. And it's hard to go through it sometimes.
I thank you for sharing that. You know, both, I guess, for yourself, and I can see the pain in doing that, but also the very realness of what we're all into in terms of some of these things. One of the things that I've learned from a pastor was that when a family was making arrangements, he would go along and be the fighter, the advocate, by saying, just be quiet and let me try and handle this, if you're willing. And if you could do that, sometimes it doesn't have to be a pastor, it could be anybody. And I'm kind of thinking that might be a good thing for some of the congregations to do again, is to put together a group who would do some caring and all the different kinds of things that need to be done at a time like this. But one of the things they can do is say, will you please itemize all those things? And force out the itemization. It seems to me that that's our responsibility, the funeral industry, to help them be above board. Those caskets, Pat told me, cost less than $100. Now, that's 10, 15 years ago. I remember that when we went to one funeral director, they did what I'd heard. They took us into the casket room, and the plain wooden casket, which this is one thing that we've talked about, if we go to a casket, that's where it's going to go. The one that they had there, the wood was warped. And so even as they said, that's the county casket. County brought for me, you know, this is the pauper's casket. So don't, you know, if you don't want to be known as, you know, a piker, that's surely the one you don't want. Because if you're going to say to somebody, that's a, you know, I don't like that. And the only way I know to do is either have somebody go with you as an advocate or to try and do it. But now the other thing I feel most important to say is that right now the only thing you know is that you did what you could at the time with what your emotion allowed. And it seems to me that that's the gift, you know, that you have to receive, because it's all you could do. And that's the gift we all want to give to each other, I mean to our children and family. I saw there, wow, here I think was first place.
Did you ever occur that you are giving jobs to some people, including mowing your lawn, taking care of the perpetual cemetery and so forth? So
yes.
It isn't all wasted.
Correct.
Something else I want to say, don't worry about Esther cleaning up your mess in the basement. I had a husband who died in December, and I always said he's got the messiest garage in the world and it needs cleaning up. Now the garage sits there as a shrine. Nobody disturbs it.
And did you hear that, Esther? I see, here and then there. There, I see. Okay.
I take a family living class of high school seniors to the mortuary, and as we left this last time, the mortician said, if I had a request, it would be that could you open it up to other students, and we never had anybody else come in, and we would like to have this. And he was very good at sharing what his costs are, what the costs are to you. The seniors have all kinds of questions. I've gone through two very close deaths, family deaths, and I learned all kinds of things, even having gone through the experience several times. So I'm saying that it's most worthwhile. I think this is a small highway town. You may be surprised also at the openness of the willingness and even like to have you do this.
Yes.
And at a time when you're not in the emotion of it.
There,
well, we didn't hear that back here.
Okay. She was saying that she had taken some high schoolers to a funeral establishment, and that she found that the funeral director was very open, caring, pleased that the young people were there, willing to talk about things when it was not a matter of stress, and wanting additional people to come. And I think that's saying that there are many of them who have a very caring kind of sense of ministry to other people.